This is Stephen Gregory. I'm sitting in the home of Professor Hillel Gildan. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. And I look forward to this interview.
Okay. You studied with Professor Strauss at the University of Chicago?
Yes.
And around 1950?
1952. Actually, I couldn't have begun until the winter semester, the winter quarter of 1953. But I heard him deliver the Progress or Return lectures at Hillel House, and that is what got me interested in studying with him.
So you heard him at Hillel House, and then you looked him up as someone you might take courses with.
I registered for his courses.
What was the first course you took with him?
You know, I thought I remembered it, but I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I just remember that the first three courses were on Machiavelli, Hobbes, and Plato's Statesman. And then later there were courses on Rousseau and Montesquieu, and then he went off, I think, to Israel. So that's the sequence I recall.
And how did you find Leo Strauss as a teacher?
Illuminating, prepared, needless to say. I mean, by that standard, more prepared than any teacher I've ever had before. Accessible, and the things he was saying, and the examples he used to illustrate the points he was making. Excellent at dealing with questions that students asked. And I found that the students were capable of asking better questions in the atmosphere created by one of his classes than they were outside the atmosphere. He established a framework that made that happen. I'm sure it'll get reflected in the tapes that you're publishing and the transcripts that you're bringing out.
That's an interesting remark, that the students would ask better questions in the context of the classes than they might ask outside the class.
Yeah, a framework was established for the subject under discussion.
And when he gave his classes, I'm told he would typically assign a short paper.
Yes.
Did he read your papers, your class papers?
We read them out loud to the class, and then he would comment on them.
And that would be the basis of your grade?
That plus the final exam. So there was this, this is the way the class opened. Now I learned from the transcripts that when the classes grew larger, it became necessary to assign several papers for a given session. And as a result, they could not all be read. I don't know how the decision was made, whose paper would be read and commented on, but I mean, I'm sure they were all commented on.
And how was he? I've never attended a class with this format. How was he in commenting on papers in class?
It led to an interesting discussion with the person who'd written it. And that's material you have on the tapes.
Right. They would turn it off when the student read the paper, and then the tape would begin when Strauss would begin commenting, but you often didn't know who he was commenting on. You had no context for the comments because you hadn't heard the paper.
I remember now that not all of the courses had that structure. Mm-hmm. I don't think the symposium course had that structure. Mm-hmm. That is, I don't remember any papers being read at the beginning of the symposium course. And there were times when students were asked to comment on a passage that had not yet been discussed in class. There were other times when the paper took the form of a summary of what had been said in the previous class. I do recall that, though I could no longer tell you exactly in what classes this was done, exactly in what classes that was done.
Of course. So his comments would lead to an interesting discussion with the paper giver.
There are some transcripts, the old transcripts, that have those comments.
I understand. You say Strauss was very accessible. You would go to see him after class?
Well, depending on the state of his health. And this changed, I think, as he grew older. But the classes would last longer than they were scheduled for. And I don't know whether you had that experience. I have office hours. The time the students want to talk to me is right after class. And usually there's a professor coming right in. Yeah. And once you go into the hall or say, come upstairs and so on, it's not the same thing for some reason. I mean, I remember occasions during which I saw him in his office. I no longer remember how they occurred. But there were lengthy discussions after class. There were periods that lasted much longer than the length of time assigned to them.
I've heard that he would, in the 1950s at least, that he would answer questions after class was over for 1 or 2 hours.
There you go. Yeah, and that was the time when one was most motivated to ask them because the material was fresh. And
why do you think he expended so much energy on teaching in those years? That's a tremendous commitment. It means he would have been spending 4 or 5 hours on his feet answering questions and lecturing.
I think I heard Jenny say once, he enjoyed it. Yes, I think that is true. And as age took its toll, he might have had to cut back on it somewhat, but he enjoyed it. That's why he had these reading groups.
He had reading groups separate from the courses, the official courses he taught.
Yes, I mean, during the year, even during the year in Palo Alto, when one might have thought he was away from everyone, there were others who were around, and there was a reading group. I mean, Martin Diamond was there. And
was he different in the reading groups than he was in the courses?
In the reading groups, those who took part in them were usually people who had been through his courses, and they did not need to have a framework established, like, why are we studying this in the Department of Political Science? I mean, from what I've seen of some of the transcripts from St. John's College, he felt, well, now that I'm here, I don't have to do that. He actually said that on one of the transcripts.
Right, right. But then he went ahead and did it. I mean, he didn't provide a justification for his political science, but he provided a justification for why to read this book.
Yes, yes, yes. The importance of the book, yes.
So in the reading groups, he didn't feel the need to establish a framework. Was his manner with the students different at all?
Well, I guess the form was different. I mean, the ones that I experienced, short platonic dialogue, which we just went through passage by passage, discussing it as we went, him leading the discussion. It wasn't like a course on Kant where every session was, as it were, planned in advance and people were chosen to read papers. The next time one had to go on to this, the next time one had to go on to that. To that extent, it was a looser structure. And when we finished one work, we moved on to another.
Right. You took classes with Strauss for about half a dozen years?
Yeah.
And how do you think Strauss understood his own activity? How do you think he understood his role as a teacher?
Well, it was clear that he thought that political science, at least, was on the wrong track and wanted to encourage truer understanding of political life than was available in those inspired by the ideal of turning it into a natural science, deserving a place alongside the established, respectable natural sciences. That he was clearly undertaking through his reacquainting us with what one has to call common sense. In the debate with Sharon Bolan, one of them challenges him with the question, what is common sense? That's one of the hardest questions in the world to answer. But he said he will content himself with a common sense understanding of common sense. But without denying that it is, there's a place where he calls it the fundamental riddle. That's in the epilogue. That's pretty strong language from Strauss. And it's not what one usually thinks of as the fundamental riddle when one thinks of Strauss.
So one way in which he saw himself as a teacher is someone who is trying to encourage or to recover a better understanding of political life than was available through scientific political science.
Scientific in quotes.
Scientific and
scientific in quotes.
Scientific in quotes, yes. Okay.
But not science, because I mean, I remember references in the writings of the founders to recent advances that have been made in political science, and there it was not in quotes. Hume speaks of political science without embarrassment, and he doesn't mean anything that's the least bit reminiscent of mathematical physics.
Did he ever discuss with his students what the, perhaps even in the context of some of the books that you read with him, what the role of a teacher is? Certainly in the context of the Platonic dialogues he discussed.
Well, I mean, Socrates was always there, but I don't remember any. I remember hearing from others, or even reading, I think it's in Liberal Education and Responsibility, his comments on the rule of thumb he gave to students who are going to go out and become teachers. Always assume that there is some silent students in the class who is your superior in mind and heart. Take what you're doing seriously. Don't take yourself too seriously. That's how I remember it. But anyway, one can check that.
Right.
It's been written.
Was that principle of, I would call it, modesty, did you see that at work in his teaching? Did he follow his own advice, do you think?
Well, he always gave the thinker he was teaching the benefit of the doubt. Though, I mean, I must say, there are places where he permits himself to be critical, even while teaching someone. I remember finding them in the Grotius transcript, where he felt he was parading his scholarly learning a little excessively, in the Vico transcript, where he was hammering a point in repeatedly and remarked to that effect. But you know, the courses I took with him have to include the things that I read in the transcripts after there were courses I didn't hear, the subject interested me, so I consulted the transcripts. And they have to be part of the experience, although I wasn't physically there. He didn't feel that his course on the Statesman had been understood by enough people, that I do recall. So I don't think that's one he went back to. Others he would return to.
He taught the politics most frequently of any one text, and as far as I know, and I suspect that after the politics, probably the Republic was second in terms of number of courses that he offered, although I don't think we have records of several of those, but one would have to go back and look at the course records. And I don't know what he taught at the New School. I don't know if anybody has the course records for the New School.
Well, you haven't interviewed David Lowenthal?
No, we have not interviewed David Lowenthal.
I mean, he may outlast me, but he is more mortal than I am, as these things are ordinarily understood. So he probably has valuable recollections. Others have passed on Henry Maggot long ago.
In a letter to Klein in 1949, Strauss complains to Jacob Klein that students need a political teaching, and that he has to come up with a political teaching for his, in order to teach. Had you seen that letter? It's in public.
I have not read through that wonderful trove that Heinrich Meyer has made available to us. I mean, I've been teaching full-time at Queens and trying to figure out what to include in as good an introduction to philosophy course as I can teach, and still haven't been able to do so, but it keeps me. Anyway, no, please acquaint me with what you're thinking.
Well, just simply that's a provocative remark for him to have made, and that he felt that he needed to come up with a political teaching for the sake of his students. This would have been in 1949, when he was starting at the University of Chicago. I don't understand political to mean in that instance, in that context, to mean Republican or Democrat. I mean, I think that the word has much broader meaning in that context.
If he came up with one, I confess I don't know what it is. Except that I remember him quoting Max Weber's remark that accomplishing something in the political arena was like drilling a hole by hand in extremely hard wood. But clearly, extravagant hopes were identified for what they were. Though even when they were present, when he taught Nietzsche, it was not an anti-Nietzsche polemic. If there was something to be learned from a thinker, he wanted to communicate what that was. That went for Hobbes and Machiavelli as well. As far as that politics course, I think it might have been, was it 1960? I think that was, I don't know whose idea it was to have him teach undergraduates, but I think it was a younger group, not the usual older graduate students, but it was a younger group that poured into the classroom when he went through the politics with them.
That's an interesting question. Is in the courses that you attended, how many people were attending? How many people were attending his classes generally?
I get the impression that afterwards it got much bigger. And someone said something that reminded me that the class on the Statesman, a lot of people poured in. It had the subtitle, Metaphysical Foundations of the Political Philosophy of Plato. I may not be getting that perfectly right, but Metaphysical Foundations was in that. I wanted to hear what he'd have to say on that. And that was an unusual, that had to be, someone reminded me, and I did not realize it at the time, it had to be moved to a larger room than the one in which he usually taught. But while I was studying with him, the classes were not unusually large. I understand that they became unusually large in subsequent years as his students started sending their students to study with him.
Yeah. But what did Strauss want to accomplish by teaching political philosophy?
Well,
I mean, an interesting thought experiment might be if someone had come along and said that they would give him a stipend to live the rest of his life out reading and studying and writing, he never had to teach another class again, would have he accepted that? Or was there something in teaching that he felt he needed to accomplish, just as he needed to write his books?
It's an interesting question. But those who studied with him and were impressed by what they experienced in his classroom went ahead and read his books. If they'd just been lying there on the shelves, not too many people would have become aware of what they contained. And given the amount of noise, I have the impression that if you ask the average political scientist who the more prominent thinker is, John Rawls or Leo Strauss, you'd probably get Rawls. Now, how do you combat that? It's not as though he didn't enjoy teaching. I mean, he did. I just remember one thing that I heard about. One of the first students, one of the ablest that he had, published little, became specialized in constitutional law, taught what he had to say by teaching courses in constitutional law, Leo Weinstein. And I just learned from talking to someone at the reception that he was involved in the project to tape record Strauss. But he started out very opposed to Strauss. I think Strauss told me something about that. And he was very able and very bright and kept raising objections. And by the end of the semester, Strauss had brought him around.
The quarter.
Pardon?
The quarter.
The quarter. But it was something of a struggle, and that indicated to me that it may have taken work very early on for him to establish himself and his way of looking at political life against the prevailing view at Chicago.
Right, yes. I'm told his first few classes were very poorly attended. I mean, there was very few people there. Is that right? Or he had already been teaching 3 or 4 years by the time he studied with him.
Well, I remember a seminar on Rousseau, not even a class. I mean, a small room. If I remember correctly, we sat around a table. Mm-hmm. I don't recall the exact physical layout.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the other classes were full classes. So it depends. I mean, people knew he'd written a book on Hobbes and acquired a reputation. So when he gave the Hobbes course, it was very well attended. A seminar on Rousseau, which I don't think got recorded, but which I learned a tremendous amount from. And then I remember a seminar on Montesquieu, for which I wrote a paper that was too long. Not intending to be arrogant, just not realizing that it was too long.
So Leo Weinstein had something to do with getting the project to tape Strauss's courses started. What do you know about that?
Someone told me. Now, who is this man at Roosevelt College again?
Stuart Warner.
He said that Carol Lerner... He was the one who told me that Carol Lerner told Leo Weinstein, and this is how far back it goes, and Bob Horowitz, that they not only have to get Strauss's permission, but that they have to get a letter saying that they have his permission, and that they have to get that letter notarized. So it's the first time I learned that. The first time I learned that Leo Weinstein had anything to do with that. But I could see it's happening because he saw the difference between the old way of studying political life and the way of studying political life that Strauss encouraged.
So it was Weinstein and Horowitz who were the students who had pushed for the taping?
This is what I learned from Stuart Warner.
Okay.
I did not know it. I knew that Horowitz had played a role, and I conveyed the version of it I got from him. You know, Strauss said, okay, if I don't have to have anything to do with it, by which I think he meant if I don't have to read the transcripts and make mm-hmm. corrections and the like. But that Leo Weinstein and Carol Lerner were in on it from way back, that I did not know.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. Is this news to you?
Well, I had been told that students of Strauss had been the impetus behind this project, but all that I knew about the organization of the project was that Storing and, I'm told, Cropsey, after Cropsey arrived in Chicago, kind of took charge of the organization of this. And there were grants that were gotten from the Realm Foundation, and I don't know, that they probably applied for those grants. So I didn't know the names of the students who were behind the transcript project. Carol Lerner is someone who can be asked for her recollections, and it'll be interesting to have a conversation with Carol.
I think Stuart Warner said, apparently he was a little annoyed at the impression created by my saying. Strauss said, go ahead, as long as I have nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
So he said, I have a copy of the letter in my briefcase. You know, I was astonished to learn that this letter existed, that Carol Lerner had anything to do with it, that Leo Weinstein had anything to do with it, and he actually had a copy of it.
Warner had a copy of the letter.
That's what he said. I did not ask to see it.
I see. Well, I'll also have to give Stewart a call and find out what he knows. That's very interesting. So Weinstein had come with a point of view that was hostile towards what Strauss was teaching, but he was interested. He came to the class, and by the end of the quarter, he had turned around and became one of those with Horowitz who wanted to see this teaching preserved.
Yes.
Do you think their interest was in seeing it preserved or simply to make it available to those who were attending the course to use just as lecture notes for them to have personally to study? I mean, what do you think their motives were in arranging for the recording?
They felt something was happening that was immensely important, and they wanted to contribute to its success. They have a common sense understanding of political life. There's common sense again with getting trampled underfoot. That would be, I mean, surmising this. This is not, as a matter of fact, there is something Horowitz once said to me that indicated he felt as though he was taking part in a kind of reformation. The political science profession. But of course, what Strauss got across, without explicitly saying it, was that he was trying to restore an older notion of philosophy, and one that included Plato and Machiavelli and Aristotle and Hobbes, but still.
So Strauss was engaged in a project of restoration.
Yes, and but of course at the same time, he acknowledged that things had been learned since the days of the ancients, which made the confidence of the moderns felt, at least for a while, in having surpassed them, which helps understand the existence of that confidence. And it also implied that some of the solutions offered by the ancients in most perspective need to be reconsidered, by which...
During Strauss's lifetime, a new term entered the lexicon of political science, that is, Straussian. What did Strauss think of that, that there were now people running around who were called by others Straussians?
I don't recall his ever discussing it. I don't recall his ever saying anything explicit about it. I mean, as regards to contemporary affairs, he was remarkably open to disagreement. It was different from disagreeing with him about whether there should be a flat tax instead of this arcane income tax structure. It was very different from disagreeing with him about whether something he said about Maimonides was true. And people did, and you know, they simply felt they could.
So your experience of actually conversing with Strauss was of an open-minded dialogue?
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And you're bringing that up now suggests that the word Straussian suggests to your mind the opposite.
Well, falsely, yeah.
Yeah, falsely.
But I mean, but since we don't think highly of John Rawls, and since we don't accept scientism or ordinary language philosophy, which also doesn't accept scientism, who are these strange people? So the things that...
Do you think Straussian is a useful term?
Kantian? Hegelian? I guess they're all misleading. I'm told the neo-Hegelians are not really neo-Hegelians. So I guess they're more in need of being intelligently understood than other terms might be. But when I have accepted the label, it was, I'm not going to disown something that
what
I found enlightening.
What does that term mean to you? If you were to, if someone were to come to you and say, I guess as I am now, but what is a Straussian? How would you gloss that?
Well, I would walk the well-trodden path of historicism, neo-positivism, paleo-positivism, what the alternative to them is. But beyond that, the importance of an understanding of human affairs for an understanding of the possible answers to the great questions of philosophy. So it comes back to, well, how should one understand human affairs? Well, so I would have to say, well, not that way, and not that way, and not that way. And then what are the issues that would have to be faced? And we're back to that. One student suggested that a lifelong effort The historicist he took most seriously was Heidegger, mm-hmm. and he did not think that the common argument against historicism sufficed to refute Heidegger, namely that they make an exception for themselves and claim to be timelessly valid, because Heidegger represents that, and what fate has allocated, that insight is what fate has allocated to our age. But to show that it fails to face up to questions about good and bad, right and wrong, admirable, contemptible, their sources. Incidentally, there is a passage in the end of the first part of What is Political Philosophy, where he says that thoughtful historicists recognize these things, but fail to accord them the full importance that is due them. And that is the source. So it's not as though they don't think there's such a thing as courage or arrogance. It gets very subtle. But yeah, I mean, connected with the restoration of a sound understanding of political life, that just walks us into the confrontation between the great ancients and the great moderns, and so on, is a restoration of a sound understanding of philosophy. And that is always at the back of his mind.
So if I were to unfairly summarize your answer in one sentence, that if one wants to refer to Straussians, Straussians are those who are looking to recover a healthy understanding of philosophy while engaging in the greatest philosophical challenges facing us today. Something like that. I think I lost the thread of your answer. I'm sorry.
Well, the focus on the political, the moral, and the religious, and the right way to face the issues they raise, and then the larger implications thereof.
When I first mentioned the term Straussian, you immediately responded with, well, they're Kantians, they're Hegelians, or there were, I don't know if there are any today. Do you think Strauss wanted there to be a Straussian school in the same way that there was a Kantian or Neo-Kantian school or Hegelian school or the Academy back in ancient days?
Well, he certainly didn't teach us any articles of faith if he did. That's not what we experienced.
You were enrolled in the Committee on Social Thought?
Yeah.
But you were able to take classes with Strauss? Yeah. Was Strauss on your dissertation committee?
Yep.
And what your dissertation was on?
Spinoza's Theological Political Treatise.
Okay. How did you arrive at your topic?
Well, originally he suggested Shaftesbury, and I thought I wanted to work on a greater philosopher than that. So I suggested Leibniz. He knew that that was impossible. Waited until I found out. And then we settled on the Theological Political Treatise, which I had taken his
course. Which, of course, he had written on.
Which he had written on, and I read what he'd written and I'd taken his course on it.
Was he the chair of your committee?
Yeah.
And how did he perform as chair? What did he do?
Well, he was thorough.
Did he read drafts? Did he wait until he had a completed draft and he read that? Did
he approve comments? He approved the completed draft. And there was something in it that was, I thought, good and worthy of publication. When Marjorie Green asked him to submit a piece for a book on Spinoza, a collection of essays that she was editing for Dover, he explained that he couldn't, but he recommended me. I had made a favorable impression on David Green somewhere along the lines, and whatever was valuable in that dissertation, I put into that paper. I can't bear to look at it. I know others who've had similar experiences. Marty Diamond said he wrote his holding his nose, as he expressed it. But then he looked at it many years later and said, you know, it's not so bad. Well, taught a course in the Theological Political Treatise, and when I taught that course, I realized that I missed a very crucial point, just mentioned in passing. Like, why were there all these rebellions against the true God and ceremonies to all these bad gods, idols and so on, and kings wanting to legislate and prevented from doing so by the way the thing was structured? Is that Spinoza's analysis? I totally missed that.
Did Strauss give comments on your completed draft?
Yes. I don't remember the process at this point. I don't know if you don't remember the details of the process. I remember there were criticisms. I don't recall whether I submitted a draft to him, how to make corrections. I know I didn't have to resubmit it. I had more of a problem getting it typed up in accord with the university.
The university is very strict about the correct quarter inch wide margin.
You had to employ one of their typists. In order to get it right. And even then, that's where I got things bounced back at me. There were certain pages I quoted not only the page but the line numbers, but I didn't do it everywhere. So the rule came down, either do it always or not at all. I don't know how to do it always.
Spinoza was not only a great early modern thinker, he was also a Jew. Do you think that entered into Strauss's, in your conversations with him about what to settle on for a dissertation, do you think that Spinoza's Jewishness played into Strauss's recommendation?
No, I don't think it did. I have the impression.
I raise the question because your introduction to Strauss was Progress and Return. And so, in a way, you encountered him, first of all, by what he had to say about Judaism.
Well, you're right to bring that up because at first it looks like a clear case is going to be made for Return. Mm-hmm. And then it turns into the debate between Return and Spinoza. Mm-hmm. And that crops up again in his later preface to the new translation of Spinoza's Critique of Religion. But no, I don't think that played a role. I mean, my suspicion is that he was saying, get it over with. I mean, you know, you've taken a course, you've read what I've written. These words do not get uttered. So go and, you know.
As you got to know Strauss over the years, was his Jewishness significant in any way to the Strauss you encountered in the classroom at the University of Chicago? I mean, at Hillel House, he gave not only Progress and Return, but several other remarkable lectures on Jewish topics.
Let's see. Not that I can think of. But that may not mean that it wasn't there. I mean, I don't know how to improve on that answer.
Okay, that's fair. You have had a full career as a professor of political science, political philosophy, but you have also had a career as an editor, the founder of Interpretation. Leo Strauss often published an Interpretation after you founded it.
Yeah.
So these would have been the last years of his life. Did you consult with Strauss about founding Interpretation? Did you do that independently? And then what was the relationship there?
We came up with the idea. Seth Benedetti, Howard White, and I. I remember riding in a taxi with Strauss. I don't quite recall the occasion. There were a few occasions when he came to New York. I said we hadn't decided on a name. And he suggested Interpretation.
Yes.
And I thought that was wonderful. Interpretation, the Journal of Political Philosophy.
Leo Strauss suggested.
He suggested Interpretation. I don't remember whether he suggested Interpretation. Mm-hmm. I don't remember whether he suggested Interpretation, the Journal of Political Philosophy. Mm-hmm. And we did it. And it was originally published by NIHA because the exchange rate was good. And then when the exchange rate became bad, they cut back on their copy editing. And Klein was very displeased with the result.
What was the original idea when you and Howard White and Seth Benedetti discussed the journal? What was the original idea for the journal?
There's some good ideas we didn't implement. Seth Benedetti suggested that we start reviewing old books. He didn't mean Plato and Aristotle, but he meant some important work of 19th century scholarship that people have forgotten about, but that's something that will draw people's attention to it. And we've never really done that. We've just been, once you have a journal, it keeps you going. You have to deal with emergencies that show up, and they keep showing up. And the time to do long-range planning begins to pretty much vanish. Just keeping your head above water is often the best you can do. That's something I had to learn and have been living with once the thing was launched.
When Strauss published an Interpretation, he would contact you and say, I have an article, and
and it went.
Right. Okay. Many of Strauss's students have published Interpretation.
They did. I mean, they began there. And their students now are writing reviews for us. It succumbed to the recession when I suddenly realized we weren't getting sufficient subscriptions from college libraries for the thing to keep going. College libraries were cutting back their budgets. They're journal budget. Mm-hmm. And when times got tight, so we went electronic, and I am currently dealing with an ongoing crisis finding a copy editor to replace the wonderful copy editor we had, who had been looking for a long time for a teaching position, and finally found one, and had to devote himself full time to the teaching he was required to do. So this is the current emergency that's keeping me from any long-range planning, which would have to include, why haven't we reviewed Straussophobia yet?
Do you see interpretation having a, I mean, not entirely by accident, it's always had a special relationship to Strauss and his students. Do you see it having a particular role to play in terms of Strauss's thought or the thought of Strauss's students?
Well, I think they represent a healthy current. I think they're misunderstood to the extent that people falsely believe them to be marching to the same tune. Mm-hmm. Anyone who knows the least thing about them mm-hmm. knows better than that.
Ralph Lerner recommended to me a review by Father Fortin of Shadia Drury's book on Strauss, in which Father Fortin takes up the question of what a Straussian is, and then provides apparently 14 different classifications, and the result of his taxonomy is, by the time that you've finished, the term has no meaning anymore. I mean, there's so many different varieties.
It can be, but I mean, I can predict that there are no people who regard Rawls as the leading light in political theory mm-hmm. of the last 40 years. In other words, there are negative characteristics. Mm-hmm. But as for positive ones, no. Mm-hmm. No.
Was Leo Strauss a philosopher?
I think so.
What does that mean?
It's a term. Well, he did think about important philosophical questions. And there are pages about them at the beginning of The City and Man, in Natural Right and History. He did lean to a certain view of the whole, but he did not write works like The Critique of Pure Reason or Hegel's Logic. There are pages in which he spells out the Platonic-Socratic view. I mean, one would have to here go into the relation between his thought and Kant's thought, what the important areas of agreement were and what the disagreements meant, and I'm not sure I'm competent to do that. But yes, and in fact, the word keeps coming up, philosophy, in its broader sense.
He himself is reported to have said that he was not a philosopher, he was a teacher or a scholar of political philosophy.
In those lectures on Heidegger, I know I'm only a scholar. Well, if he restrict philosophy to thinkers of the stature of Plato, Aristotle, Kant, Hegel, no, he didn't consider himself a thinker of that rank. If you include Rousseau, Montesquieu, Hume, Berkeley, becomes a different matter.
After you left Chicago, obviously you stayed in touch with Professor Strauss.
Yeah.
Did you consider him your friend?
No. I mean, it always remained teacher-student. Let's say older friend.
And this was an earlier time, but I assume that you always addressed him as Professor Strauss.
I never called him Leo.
Or Mr. Strauss.
Mr. Strauss.
Mr. Strauss. Yeah. University of Chicago, you would say Mr. Strauss.
Mr. Strauss, yeah. I don't think any of his students were on a first name basis with him.
We've covered a lot of ground in the past hour. Is there anything that comes to mind you'd like to discuss about Strauss and how you knew him? And
I think we've covered the important subjects.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Well, you're very welcome.